Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent, and I am going to allow our guest today to introduce herself. She's going to discuss her work, and this is another of the Sex Work and Sexuality series.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks so much for inviting me. My name is Dilara Yarbrough. I'm an assistant professor of criminal justice studies at San Francisco State University. And my research focuses on how different types of governmental responses to poverty either perpetuate or interrupt racial and gender and class inequalities. What I'm most interested in is how grassroots movements and radical harm reduction can help end the policing of poverty. And so the book that I'm working on is called Abolitionist Care, and it describes how poverty relief services that are provided by and for sex workers and transgender women of color actually disrupt carceral logics that normally govern service provision. So in the book, I give the examples of a wonderful peer-led radical harm reduction provider in San Francisco, the St. James Infirmary, and another organization that's led by and for formerly incarcerated transgender women called the Transgender, Gender Variant, and Intersex Justice Project as models for what I'm calling abolitionist care and organizations that all of our listeners should donate to.
So today we're talking about an article that you wrote back in 2019. Can you tell us what the article is called, please?
It's called Nothing About Us Without Us. It was a long title. And it's about kind of the dominant representations of sex work and poverty in research about these topics. And it's about kind of the harmful, pathologizing, exotifying trends that we see in research about these topics.
Okay, so what prompted the article?
The article was prompted, I think, by a number of things. Number one, I was doing a lot of participatory action research and projects that I felt like, you know, directly we had a very clear goal to impact policy, and we were making policy change with teams of people directly impacted by criminalization. And so the research was very clearly a tool and a means to an end. At the same time, I was working kind of on a book project based on ethnographic research I'd done about the harms of criminalization and medicalization and all these kind of bad approaches to service provision and the harms of policing. And I also, you know, kind of working with these different groups, participated in and observed protests against other researchers whose work that, you know, whose work was very harmful and really exhibited these kind of objectifying, exotifying trends in research, but also had really detrimental policy consequences. And, you know, as I was writing about these events, it became clear to me that I also needed to kind of turn that critical lens on myself and on my own process, and really think about all of these things that were coming up. You know, should people who are not experts, because they haven't had direct experience with, you know, whatever type of oppression that they're writing about, be doing that type of writing? You know, under what conditions should that happen? How can researchers and, you know, people who have really good intentions and want to support political organizing, how can researchers make sure that they're not contributing to more surveillance and harm? And so these were the questions.
So for people that don't know, can you describe to us what participatory action research is? Because obviously it's our stock in trade, but not everyone else is as familiar.
Yeah. Yes. So participatory action research is when, in most cases, a group of people who are interested in making a policy change, who are directly affected by some type of harm in the world. In the cases of the projects that I've done, it's been, you know, the criminalization of transgender women in shelters, the criminalization of homelessness through enforcement of quality of life and anti-homeless laws, people who are themselves unhoused, wanting to intervene and end the criminalization that's affecting them. And so participatory action research just means that the research isn't just to know something, it's for the purpose of doing something, for the purpose of making a very concrete change. And in the best cases, the problem is defined and the project is directed by the people who have that lived experience with whatever the issue is that they're trying to change.
Yeah, I think this is called praxis as well, isn't it? Ferrer, I think, calls it praxis. I think Maggie O'Neill calls it praxis as well. But it is kind of, it is problematic as well, isn't it? Because it's a case of, you know, maybe someone from the outside trying to alter a problem that they perceive.
Yes, exactly. And so, yes, the question of who gets to define the problem, I think, is crucial, right? Because often when people who haven't lived and experienced that problem come from outside and want to define the problem, that problem can be perceived and defined very differently by people who are going through it every day.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the, you know, the tension that I felt in my work collaborating with organizations of, you know, unhoused activists or organizations led by transgender women of color, and just asking, what do you need from me? You know, how can my work as a researcher support your organizing work? And this kind of other type of experience that I was having as I tried to do more traditional research and writing, and was really questioning, you know, what kind of change is this going to make? Who am I to decide, you know, what's needed? And, you know, just, I think particularly with ethnography, this is a tradition that is often outsiders observing and surveilling marginalized groups, right? And so it's important for anyone who does that type of research to really be mindful of that tradition and really observe themselves as well to see how they might or might not be contributing to that.
Yeah. But also as well, I mean, I think we have to be careful as well when we sort of like as researchers, when we're studying groups that we may have belonged to at one point, but we don't always, but I still belong to that in itself, you know, sort of not only are people sort of like in and, you know, can be outside of a group, they can be inside, but their knowledge is dated.
Yeah.
So even when you've got kind of like an extra layer of access to a group by virtue of your shared history with a group, mm-hmm. you may not still be relevant, you know.
Yeah.
You may not still be relevant. And I, you know, I've researched sort of workers in areas that I've been engaged in the past. And, you know, I have to be very conscious that I don't do that. I'm not there anymore. And actually, I bring with me the shadow of the university.
Yeah.
Yeah. The shadow of the university can be quite overwhelming. It can be overwhelming for the people that you're talking to. Mm-hmm. It can give you an authority that you don't feel like you have, and you may not even notice that you have, but it can really change the power dynamics in the relationships that you're engaged with. You know, so tell us, when did you start to realize that research was and can cause harm?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, you know, rather than one moment of epiphany that I can easily identify, I think there are probably millions of small moments, right? Let's see. There are a few examples that I can think of, you know, trying to kind of navigate strategically marshaling these ideas about researchers as experts that happened early in my career, right after I got a job in a university that I could share. But I think that's a great question. I think, you know, there are so many moments, probably always, I was aware that research could cause harm, but I was surprised, I think, on multiple occasions about realizing all the different ways in which that could happen, right? And it's not as simple as, you know, the examples I share in this article of Melissa Farley and George Kelling, who are researchers who support, you know, criminalization of the sex industry, in the case of Melissa Farley, and in the case of George Kelling, of course, broken windows policing, which has harmed people of color and sex workers and all sorts of different groups of people, right? It's not as simple as kind of examples like that we all think of and can kind of point to people like that and absolve ourselves as researchers, right? Like you said, it's so much more complex. Even the assumptions that a researcher makes when they're asking someone a question in the interview context could feel harmful, right? Or even in kind of presenting research to the public or to policymakers, the designation of someone with a PhD as an expert.
Yeah.
It erases, even however unintentional it is on the part of the person with the PhD, can erase the expertise of everyone that person talked with, and all of the kind of stories that person compiled to say whatever it is that they're saying, right? And so I've learned over the years to be really cautious, even coming on a podcast like this, right? When someone asks me to step into this role of expert or researcher, or, you know, speak about the research and the work that I've done, really cautious about, you know, participating in something like that, and also about clarifying that having a degree doesn't make me or anyone else an expert. And in fact, the ways that kind of expertise is portrayed and marshaled can be very harmful.
Yeah, it can certainly maintain the status quo, even with the intention of doing some good. I acted as a consultant for somebody who was trying to do some research in Ireland, and they wanted to interview street women in a hotel. They wanted to take them off the street for a weekend. And, you know, the women that they were looking to interview are heroin addicts. How are you going to legislate that? How are you going to what's the logistics for that? You know, and then what about at the end of the weekend? Were you going to just go and drop them off the street when they've, like, you know, they're for 2 days in a luxury hotel? I mean, you know, their intentions were really good. But actually, there's so much harm inherent in that type of, you know, paternalistic approach to other people that it's, you know. It's quite shocking. It's quite shocking. But, you know, I'm a researcher as like common ground with like the people that I research. And I'm aware that sometimes I've asked questions and I've seen the impact of the question really hurt someone in a mm-hmm. situation where afterwards they're just going to go back out and hustle. And, you know, even with the best intentions, research can be harmful.
Yes.
You know? It's a bit like tourism. It spoils what it touches sometimes, you know?
Exactly. Yes. And actually, you know, I had a conversation with staff at one of the organizations that I was working with that I shared in that article that you read. And a staff member was very concerned because this organization was just being besieged by requests from researchers who wanted to talk with street-based sex workers in particular, right? This had become a hot research topic. And, you know, the staff member got fed up and said, you know, we are a place to help sex workers survive and to provide services. We're not a zoo of customizable prostitutes. Wow. And I remember that phrase. Right? Because I think that is often the way that sex workers in particular, but just in general, marginalized groups are objectified in research.
Yeah.
This kind of touristic collection of stories that don't belong to researchers, right? And curation and display.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. And you know, it's funny because I'd actually picked up that phrase from your article. I was going to ask you about that. But I won't ask you about that now. But I am going to ask you about this other really cool phrase that you used. And I want you to kind of like unpack it for me. So can you break down for us the quote that research trades in pathologization, paternalism, and extractive exotification? That's a beautiful phrase.
Extractive exotification. I mean, I think it's kind of like something you said earlier, right? It just means the researcher visits like a tourist, extracts or just takes what they think will be interesting, what they want to learn about, and then presents it in this kind of exotic way. You know, Victor Rios says something similar called the Jungle Book trope, right? Where someone goes into this unfamiliar land and lives to tell the tale, right? And a lot of presentations in research feel like this. It's extraction, it's taking without giving anything back, and it's exotifying, portraying groups of people as almost like specimens.
I'm quite aware of the, you know, like over the course of my own research, I've become quite aware of there's almost like a touristy element. And what happens to your guides when you've left? How does that, you know, you get taken into the interior of whatever it is that you're researching. Right. What happens to the guides after you left? How are they then sort of you know, considered by their community, but also as well, you know, how are you, you know, what is it that you actually get to see? Yeah, are you seeing like a performance?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or are you seeing the kind of like, you know, the highlighted version of what people think will interest you?
Yeah, and I think that's often the case, right? So the place where I live, the San Francisco Bay Area, there are a lot of universities, there's a lot of research going on. And something that I noticed, you know, while I was working with a lot of organizations and kind of doing my own research, is people would ask me, do you know of any studies I can be in, right? Because it's a way to make money through a gift card or a stipend. And I noticed that people often kind of tailored their stories or even their medical history in the case of medical studies to the criteria of the study, really trying to give the researchers what they wanted as just another way to get what's needed for survival. Mm. And so I think we also have to consider how research is its own kind of economy, right? It's an industry.
Yeah, I have like this huge issue around like the payment of participants, because they should be paid. But the amount that the universities especially are prepared to pay seems to pretty well fall in line with what they're prepared to pay sort of like, you know, sort of like practice, like academics, you know, sort of like PhD students and stuff like that, who ultimately are going through some sort of like almost like an apprenticeship. So they are ultimately going to end up earning a lot more money. But, you know, to pay someone for what is basically a part of their narrative that they've then got no control over, to pay them a pittance, I think, A, it's really bad, because it really skews research around those who are either desperate or don't have time on their hands, often because they're less busy with what they're doing. Now, when I was studying sort of like webcam performers, and I would offer them, you know, what the university had given me to offer, which was a £20 like book token, and they'd be like, yeah, go away, I'm on like 200 quid an hour, I don't want to talk to you. And then I had to get real, I had to say to them, listen, it works talking to me, because actually, if you don't talk for yourself, you get spoken for. And, you know, in my research, what I'm seeing is everyone focusing on your engagement with the customers, and nobody's talking about your engagement with the webcam hosting site. You know, so either don't speak or speak so that you can actually be heard, you know, put the money to one side. But I felt I was able to do that because we had that sort of common ground. But, you know, the element of money needs to be addressed, I believe. You know, yeah, we need a grown-up conversation about that.
I think so too. I mean, I also think, you know, that it's a good hustle. Like it's a good way to participating in research projects in the most expedient way possible is really a way that some people make money. And so the issue for people who don't just do these kind of one-off, one interview or one, you know, blood draw or whatever, all these types of research, I think the issue, just as you said, is to really create a situation where as much as possible, people have ownership and agency and choice in deciding what stories they'll tell and how those will be presented. And so a colleague of mine, Jennifer James, I really learned a lot from her way of doing research, because, you know, she had this method based in the tradition of Black feminist methods, where she collaboratively with her research participants kind of created the narratives. And so she would, you know, interview someone, write down their a story, listen to the story, and show them the story, and then work on that story again together, right? Yeah. And so I think, and knowing her, I know that this is a true process of collaboration and not the kind of coercion that so often happens in research. And that to me was really inspiring and helped me think about these issues, about narrative and who owns narratives. But it is an anxiety that continues to consume me as I work on this book.
But I think as well, it also puts a kind of a responsibility on the researcher to try and access populations without the use of a gatekeeper. You know, I spoke to someone earlier today whose podcast comes out immediately before this one, about the queer repossession of the word ratchet. And she talks about her access to Black queer women who aren't accessed because she actually belongs to that community, you know. And so that's an important thing as well, is to sometimes make sure that, you know, that you're not going through the same sort of channel, so that you're not interviewing the same people, you know, like otherwise. And that in itself skews the research, because I've been making myself very unpopular for a while, because I'm saying we can't always be going to activist groups, because not everyone, for example, in the case of sex workers, mm-hmm. is an activist. In fact, most sex workers aren't activists, because most sex workers don't come into contact with the police, or the authorities. They just, it's a side hustle that doesn't really, you know, doesn't bring them into contact with the criminal justice system. So, you know, that and that means that there's a whole pool of people that we're not necessarily accessing. So, you know, as researchers, we have to be so kind of aware. So anyway, so you describe your research as an intellectual ethnography. What do you mean by that?
Yes, so that means that I'm not doing an ethnography of people as the object of study. I'm not looking at marginalized people as an object of study. My research is not about sex workers. My research is not about unhoused people. My research is partly about the production of knowledge about these groups, and also by these groups of people. Mm-hmm. But that's again kind of turning the lens on the research industry and on how knowledge is produced, which wasn't something I was thinking about a whole lot when I started doing research, but it became something that I started to think about more and more. And I also think, you know, the question of whether and under what conditions ethnographic research with marginalized groups should be done is an important one. I think if this type of research is done, it should be about systems of oppression. The object of study should be the institutions that are producing inequality. It should be state violence and how that works. And while it's true that the experiences of people who are most directly affected by state violence do provide a unique lens, I would also raise the question for any researchers who might be listening of how, especially, you know, if they're thinking of doing work with marginalized groups or in solidarity with marginalized groups, how researchers might be able to kind of marshal our ability to access institutions like police departments or other state agencies that are perpetrating these harms in ways that are hidden. And so can the traditions of, close observation and analysis, and honestly, sometimes surveillance, be turned on the kind of hidden machinations of of the state and kind of illuminate those processes maybe in a different way. So that's a question that I think is very valuable for researchers to think about.
It's like a sort of pragmatic approach to actually how you can actually come together, and rather than sort of like, you know, solve a problem that's perceived, is to actually gather knowledge before you even ask a question.
Exactly.
I have a large issue with, you know, sort of like a lot of research that sets out to answer a question. Is a question even valid? Is a question valid if you've generated it from loads of other sort of like, you know, academic research, which is quite often second or third hand produced?
Yes.
So can you tell us how, you talk in your article about oppressive knowledge production. How has that impacted the field of poverty research?
Partially in the ways that we talked about of treating people as objects and treating poverty as the result of individual decisions, or, you know, kind of the tradition of research about poverty often invisibilizes the institutional and political and economic processes that cause poverty, right? By focusing in on poor people, researchers often make it seem like the cause of poverty is poor people. We will never end poverty by studying poor people, because people experiencing poverty do not cause poverty. Poverty is caused by these bigger systems and processes. Similarly, the question that is often asked related to sex work, particularly in criminology, is why do people get into sex work and what's the most effective way to get them out? That's the wrong question, because that assumes that it assumes that sex work is a problem, right? Sex work is not a problem. The problem is so many problems, right? But an exploitative, low-wage labor market, racial capitalism, you know, conditions that affect all workers in the formal and informal economy, that are caused by kind of the bigger systems that then become invisibilized when researchers focus on marginalized people as objects of study.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, Turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I think always the question would be, well, why is sex work so attractive?
Yeah.
Not what's wrong with it. It's like, why is it so attractive?
Why is it so attractive to researchers, right?
Why is it so attractive to the people who do it? I mean, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? Because if you kind of got into conversations about, you know, like the amount of time that you then have on your hands to do other stuff, you know, that's what I was getting through with my research. People have time on their hands if they do sex work, because they don't have to work for very long. You know, and if you're doing it online, you don't have to go anywhere to do it. You just roll your camera on and then roll it off a couple of hours later with a few hundred dollars in your hand. Perfect.
Yeah. I mean, it can be a great vehicle for having lots of time and having mobility, right? I think also for a lot of people who I've talked with who've experienced housing deprivation and who have worked in low wage formal economy jobs, right? People I've talked with have gone from telemarketing into sex work, from construction into sex work. You know, someone told me about experiencing anti-Black racism and discrimination in his job as a construction worker, and doing sex work became a way to earn enough money after the conditions of that low wage, exploitative, racist, formal labor market became untenable. And so I think part of the problem with a lot of research about sex work and sex workers is it just kind of freezes people in this one kind of moment in time, in this one, like this job becomes some kind of deviant identity.
Yeah,
it's a job. It's a way people make money, right?
I keep thinking it more and more in terms of like punctum, where you focus on that one incident, that one image. You know, there's a real fetishization about it. So back to the article. I love the phrase, "The intention to contribute to social change does not preclude openness to a multiplicity of viewpoints or threaten the validity of finding."
Mm-hmm.
Talk us through that.
Okay. So there are a lot of people in the research world who think that research should be a pure and objective quest for knowledge about something, that researchers should not have an idea of the political or economic changes that need to happen in the world around them, that researchers shouldn't work with political organizers, and, you know, should kind of stay away from applied policy commentary, because some people think that this biases research. There are many things wrong with this perspective. Right. We know from feminism and feminist research that objectivity is a myth. And that this myth has been used to empower people with, you know, more power and more privilege in society to kind of extract and objectify and comment on the lives of marginalized people in ways that perpetuate the status quo, right? Yeah. And so objectivity, usually when people are calling for objectivity, they're calling actually to continue the status quo.
And the silencing.
Yes, and continue the silencing of people other than themselves who, you know, are the objective experts, quote unquote.
Yeah. We're not going to get even into the discussion of who wants those kind of like, you know, those remote, unattached, unbiased findings. But you'll find a lot of them, you know, a lot of male, white, male, cis, you know, global Northwest. We'll leave it there. Can you describe how your work engages with the notion of respectability politics, please?
Yes. So respectability politics is kind of this idea that the more sympathetically that one can portray members of a marginalized group, and I'm putting sympathetically in quotes, right, to kind of mainstream dominant society, right, the better the political outcome will be. And so a lot of times, even people in kind of left political movements can be concerned about engaging with the fact that some people who don't have housing do criminalized work to survive, including sex work, right? Some people who don't have housing use drugs. And sometimes in political organizing around housing justice and in research as well, the many, many people who are concerned about this idea of respectability would say, let's not talk about people who are doing things that kind of mainstream society would deem not respectable or not appropriate, because we want to have the best political impact that we can, and that requires a sympathetic portrayal.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that logic is really about political expediency, but the people who end up being harmed by that approach to research and to organizing are the people who are most marginalized, people who are whose survival strategies and identities are criminalized, and who can get left behind when researchers or organizers put, you know, kind of uncritically accept these mainstream ideas about respectability. And so for me, I think it's really important to challenge the idea that some activities or some types of work are respectable and some are not.
Yeah.
I think we need to say that logic is wrong, and we can't let that into our work, our research work, or our political work.
But also as well, it's a really convenient way of sidestepping the damage of some political politics, because I'm thinking about an interview that I did with a woman about a year or two ago, and she was a sex worker, but she'd not been arrested for, she'd just come out of prison. I interviewed her on a Sunday. She'd been released from prison on Wednesday. She'd not eaten in that time. She literally had the clothes that she stood in. And she was rough sleeping, and she's like, her drug use was really intense and quite heavy. Well, very heavy. And she's like, well, why wouldn't I use? But she was constantly being arrested for having, like, you know, crack pipes. She wasn't being arrested for sex work, because nowadays the narrative is around, you know, viewing sex workers, street sex workers, as victims, but she's still being arrested.
Yeah.
It's just the narrative has been arrested. But, you know, when you looked at a sort of her personal history, there was no reason not to use. Why wouldn't you use? You know?
Yeah.
But if you sort of like, if you sort of whitewash those stories, what you do is you just have someone whose behavior just seems problematic and bizarre.
Right. Yeah. And it erases a part of people's lives that is important, right? When we think about, or when I think about a lot of people who participated in my research, a lot of people experience policing, not just related to sex work, but related to race and gender identities, right? Like police profiling of women of color, of transgender women, as well as laws against drug use and possession, laws criminalizing homelessness and migration. And so when we kind of just extract one little part of a story or experience out and make that the thing, just like you said, I think it weakens our movements as well as our analysis.
But it also really impacts our credibility with the people that we're trying to communicate with. So can you tell us, like, you talk really interestingly in your article about the two protests that the paper explores. Can you talk us through them, because they were awesome?
Yeah, I thought they were awesome too. I really enjoyed them. So protest number one happened in the basement of the San Francisco Public Library, where a researcher, very prolific researcher, Melissa Farley, who has written a lot about, the sex industry and why she thinks it should be criminalized. And she was on a panel in the library with some local law enforcement officials talking about sex trafficking. Sex workers decided to protest this event, right? Of course, no sex workers were invited to speak. It was this panel of experts who were actually vociferously and adamantly continuing to do harm and to silence the voices of directly affected people despite repeated protests, right? And so sex workers came to protest this event. The audience was filled, all the seats were filled with sex workers and supporters with red tape covering their mouths to, of course, demonstrate the silencing of people who should have been invited to speak on this panel instead. And, you know, there was, at the end, some people shared verbally stories about why Melissa Farley's research and why her insistence on speaking for people who could very well speak for themselves was harmful. And she dismissed the sex worker activists as quote unquote the sexually exploited elite, right? Like saying, I guess to her that meant false consciousness of a sort, right? Like somehow she was qualified to speak for them because they didn't know what was happening for to them or something, right? Mm-hmm. So a literal silencing, and just this incredible paternalism in not even acknowledging the perspectives of the many activists that came to protest her panel and her research. And so that was the first event, and that, I think that's an important example of paternalism in research.
Yeah, I think it almost verges on imperialism, because when you talk about this, I think about Spivak and the voice of the subaltern is taken from them and is replaced by the voice of the missionary who knows your story better. You know, it's like, it's almost like you imagine them like sort of like dressed up for safari. They are that colonial, you know. It's outrageous. And what was the second one? The second one was quite poignant as well.
Yeah, and in the second one, George Kelling, who of course, kind of pioneered the theory of broken windows, in which kind of low level quality of life issues should be responded to, according to him, with aggressive policing. Was invited to the U.S. Conference of Mayors here in San Francisco to speak as a keynote speaker. And of course, this is during a time when, you know, thousands of tickets for sitting, sleeping, resting in public space are being given to unhoused people on the streets of the city. Criminalization is ramping up. And this researcher is here to recommend that the criminalization should continue, right? And so, of course, people who were experiencing the brunt of this policing organized to protest. And notably, the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness and Poor News Network came and kind of eviscerated Kelling's research and, spread information to passerby about the practice of what Poor News Network calls WeSearch, which really affirms the expertise of people who are living whatever the issue is. I recommend, Poor has a new book about poverty scholarship that I definitely recommend to any listeners who are interested.
Okay, cool. I'll add that to the blog. There'll be a blog attached to this, and I'll add this information to the blog. So if anyone's interested, they can go and research it. So, I always find it so shocking. It's such a money-making sort of like aspect as well. The amount of money that's been generated from fines because of those sort of researches as well. Your article it really discusses it's really sort of reflective, and it talks about research humility in the ethnographic context. So can you take a minute to discuss how your observations of humility in the context of, say, your research and the sex and the service providers in the peer-run clinics for sex workers? I really enjoyed that.
In the peer-run clinic for sex workers, providers, of course, were almost always current or former sex workers themselves, right? But also were people very attuned to differences in economic and housing stability, experiences across race and gender, substance use, and kind of all of the kind of axes of difference that could create those power imbalances and kind of that had the potential to undermine the goals and efficacy of peer-led care, which is to let people be the experts on their own experience and to provide survival resources without judgment, without strings attached, without stigma. Right. And what I saw among staff at this clinic was so powerful because they really took the time to reflect on their own identities and experiences.
Positionality,
but more than just reflecting, right? They understood kind of the limits of kind of their own embodied experience or visceral knowledge of something, right? If a sex worker who worked in porn or who did indoor sex work was providing peer counseling, with someone who did street-based sex work, the recognition of that staff member was, you know, this person has their own experience. I need to honor that. I need to know what I don't know. And I need to let them direct the process and kind of share their needs. And it sounds very simple. But of course, you know, we know that in most places where services are provided, those services come with strings attached. They come with punishment and with moralizing discourses and with attempts to control people's behavior. And they come with condescension and they come with, you know, literally in the case of one place I visited with a participant, signs that say things like, you're not working unless you're working on yourself, you know, just really, really harmful things. And so I think the intentional ethos of humility and recognition that, you know, there are things that people who haven't directly experienced them just don't know. And that the important thing is to be a good listener and, you know, support someone in whatever way they're asking for. Watching that made me really think about how that can also apply to research, not just service provision, right? And I think, you know, particularly in research, I guess like service provision, there's a similar type of general mainstream culture of professionalism and expertise. And I think we really have to undo that.
Yeah.
And recognize that and really hope for ourselves that, you know, we can admit when we don't know something. You know, we can always hope that we'll learn every single day and wake up tomorrow, you know, smarter than we were the day before, right? These are things that I always hope for myself. But I think the really key element is listening and not directing or coercing.
But also as well, I think sometimes people just have to get over their guilt of not belonging to a marginalized community. I'm sorry you don't belong to a marginalized community. Forgive yourself. Yeah, let's have a look what qualities you've actually got that is of use for this community. And I like how you describe solidarity research, like within the context of this article. So can you kind of like talk us through solidarity research and how it contrasts to, say, participatory active research?
Yeah.
And how you use it in this article.
Yes. And so I like what you said about, you know, often people just kind of wallowing in guilt and doing nothing, because that is not the point of reflexivity, right? I think, you know, I'm not sure whether guilt is a particularly useful emotion or not. I think people should just try to get to that next step of taking action in a thoughtful way, right? So I think that participatory action research, like we talked about, is done with a team, right? Often it's a team of people who are directly affected by the problem, and so they're defining the problem. Supported by a researcher from a university, often, but not always. In solidarity research, the researcher is not, you know, working with a team of researchers who themselves are directly affected for whatever reason. You know, maybe it starts out as a dissertation, maybe it's you know, folks are busy trying to organize politically and survive, and research doesn't seem like the best use of their time in this context. But that doesn't mean that that research project can't have kind of social and political change goals that are defined in collaboration with, people who are most directly affected by the problems at hand. And so to me, what solidarity means is providing support in a way that, is defined by the participants in the project. Yeah. A lot of times that's explicitly asking what they need.
Yeah. What can
you
I do?
If I can support that, then I'm of course going to. But research is inherently political. Knowledge production is inherently political. It is not objective.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's really funny because a colleague of mine a few weeks ago did a webinar that was aimed. She's an out sex worker named Victoria Holt, and she did a webinar for researchers, and she talks about the kind of orientalism of sex workers by some researchers, and I think there's come a time where actually, there's a kind of almost an exoticism around sex workers that maybe what people need to do is own the fact that they want to be around sex workers and just own that. It's like, yeah, I want to be around, like, not I'm here to help. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, I think sometimes maybe our biggest skill set as researchers is the fact that we've got access to stuff. Like, we've got access to journals, we've got access to sometimes funding and stuff to make a change. We can serve a role if we work with, but we don't have to necessarily turn up with the offer of help. I'm here to help, I'm here to rescue.
Right, because help is rescue, it's colonial, right? And I think that the best type of support is often material support.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of times that means money. Yeah. And so if researchers can get resources from a university in the form of money or stipends or whatever else, that can often be more helpful. I think. Yeah.
More long-term ethnographies, I think, are needed rather than those kind of hit and run researches. It's longer-term ethnographies. So with that in mind, who did you write this article for?
So I wrote it for researchers or people who are thinking about doing research. Mm-hmm. Because I particularly ethnographic research, and particularly ethnographic research or any type of research with marginalized groups, because I wanted to share some of my thought process and experiences in hopes that others who, were thinking about doing research or in the process of doing research or who had similar kind of questions percolating, could read it and find something useful.
I think it's a really good way to sort of center people's sort of self-awareness, their positionality, I found it really useful. I read it and I was really kind of, I reached out to you because I'd read this article and I really wanted to see where you were coming from. So this is the chance here for you, some shameless self-plugging on your part. So what are you working on now?
So I told you a little bit at the beginning about the book that I'm working on. Right now the title is Abolitionist Care. And it is really just, I think we talked about how research is always political. It's in support of the movement to end policing and kind of, policing in organizations that purport to provide care as well, right? So we've talked about criminalization of poverty, of homelessness, of sex work, but these types of carceral logics also govern most of the time the provision of services that are supposed to relieve poverty, right? And they end up these services, including homeless shelters, including drug rehab, end up actually perpetuating poverty and inequality. And so what I really felt, what made me feel hopeful, was seeing how that could be different. And so, you know, there are two wonderful organizations here in San Francisco that that I really found to be examples of abolitionist care, of care that rejects carceral logics, of care that, you know, doesn't just help people survive, but helps to challenge systems of inequality. And I wanted to kind of share these examples with readers and help readers, including aspiring social workers or other, you know, service providers, imagine something different based on the ways that people are actually doing something different right now. And those are only two of, you know, many examples of people who are providing care for their own communities in ways that really challenge oppression and inequality.
Excellent. So just as we round this up, can you just give us the name of the article that we've just reviewed and who you are?
Yes. So my name is Dilara Yarbrough, and my article is Nothing About Us Without Us, Reading Protests Against Oppressive Knowledge Production as Guidelines for Solidarity Research.
Excellent. And my name is Rachel Stewart, and I'm a PhD research student at the University of Kent, whose specialism is the lived experience of sex workers.